Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When Jimmy Carter first told his mother he was going to run for president, she said, "President of what?" She also once told Time magazine, quote, "There was nothing really outstanding about Jimmy as a boy." Now in a new book, the former peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, looks back lovingly on the woman he credits as the inspiration for all of his life's work. The book is titled A Remarkable Mother. President Jimmy Carter joins me in the studio, and throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How wonderful to see you, sir.
It's good to be with you again, Diane. Thank you.
Thank you. Your book begins this way. Bessie Lillian Gordy was born in Chattahoochee County, Georgia, the 15th day of August, 1898, and was one of the most extraordinary people I have ever known. That's quite a statement from a man who was president of the United States.
And I've been to, since I left the White House, about 130 nations, and she's still the most remarkable person I've known because she, I think, personified in my mind the finest aspects of what America is and what a human being ought to be. And she sacrificed her life in a way for the poorest and most destitute, darkest skinned, poverty stricken people on earth, and never felt that she was making a sacrifice. She always felt that she was exhilarated and getting a great deal more out of every adventure that she had than she was putting into it.
And, of course, she went to India with the Peace Corps in her seventh decade. She said she wanted to be associated with darker-skinned people. She wanted to be in a poor country. But she wasn't very happy early on when she got there.
No, she wasn't. She was an accomplished registered nurse, almost a doctor. And when she arrived in India, she had studied Hindi, and she was made to change her language to Marathi, and mother was the last thing from a language expert. But Mrs. Gandhi, Indira Gandhi, whom my mother never did like until much later in life, had a new family planning program, and so she put mother in charge of vasectomies for men and educating the poorest people on earth, untouchable people in India, how to restrict their production of children. And so that's what mother had to do. And some days she would help perform as many as 30 or 35 vasectomies on men. If they didn't yield to Mrs. Gandhi's pressure, their children couldn't go to public school, and the men couldn't become foremen in their factories and things of that kind. So mother felt like that was kind of a deprivation of their rights. But she started volunteering after her normal work hours in the clinic, helping a doctor, and she became so invaluable to him that eventually the owner of the whole village, that was over 20,000 people, the Godrej family, one of the richest families still in India, decided to let mother work full-time in the clinic. So that was one of the most glorious days of her life.
I was also fascinated with the idea that she had become a house mother at a university. Talk about that period of her
life. After my father died, mother kind of blossomed forth, and she was never satisfied with just mundane duties of a housewife or even a mother and a grandmother. So her sister was a house mother over at Auburn, and so mother finally decided she would go over there and join her, and she very carefully selected the most rambunctious and uncontrollable fraternity on the Auburn campus, the Kappa Alphas, who were well known for their frivolities and their, you know, departures from the law whenever they could. But this is the kind of people mother loved, and so she had 96 boys. Mother was fairly well off then. Our family had become that. That it. And so Mother always had a new Cadillac every 2 years. She would just go over and let her Cadillac be used freely by the boys. And they told her their inmost secrets when their girlfriend got pregnant or whenever they were caught doing something that was blatantly against the university rules. They would come and confide in Mother. So she kind of adopted them.
Do you think she enjoyed being a mother to you and your siblings?
Well, I think so. I always felt, though, that when she got to Auburn, her first love for children was those fraternity boys. And when she was a registered nurse and I was a child, we really were deprived of Mother's presence, because after she graduated, in effect, from serving in the hospital, she was the operating room nurse. And then later she went to nursing private patients in the hospital. And the hospital in those days paid her $4 for 12 hours duty. But then she decided she would be more helpful to the roughly 200 or 300 black people that lived around our home. We didn't have any white neighbors. So Mother would nurse them for 20 hours a day. That was a standard service. And she was supposed to get paid $6 a day for 20-hour duty. So she only got off work from a family home at 10 o'clock at night and until 2 o'clock in the morning. She would come home, change her clothes, wash her uniforms, take a shower, and then go back. So we children really didn't see Mother all that much. And so I think she always was in the habit of expanding, to answer your question, the number of so-called children that she could adopt. So, and that was, I think she kind of graduated from that early service of the poorest, most deprived people around Archery, Georgia, and transferred that love over a long period of time to the service of the poor people in India, nearby.
But, of course, as an adult now, you can appreciate what she was doing for others. But I wonder, as a young person, how you felt about her absence.
I think we were kind of jealous. I and my oldest sister, whose name is Gloria, later in life, we teased Mother. When we would come home from school in the afternoon, Mother would have been home at midnight, and she would have written us an instruction for our duties. Fill the wood box with stove wood for the wood stove, sweep the yards, feed the chickens, bring in the eggs, you know, a long list of duties. So later in life, we told, and she would put on a black desk in the front room of our house, which is still there, by the way. And so we told Mother we thought that black desk was our mother, because that's where we got all our instructions, and sometimes she would write a loving note, you know, I miss you kids, and that sort of thing.
What about your father early in life?
My father was my hero. He was a hard-working, dedicated man, a successful farmer. He was the pitcher on the American League baseball, American Legion baseball team in Sumter County. He was a catcher when he wasn't pitching. He was an outstanding hunter, fisherman, a good diver and swimmer, the best tennis player in our whole region. So he was the object of my admiration and my, I wouldn't say fear, but my total submission. Daddy very seldom expressed any loving affection for us. He was a very stern disciplinarian. He demanded perfection, particularly from his only boy at that time. Billy was 13 years younger than I. But I worshipped my father almost. And my mother was kind of a guardian between me and Daddy. I was always happy when I did something that was deserving of punishment. Mother was always eager to punish me very mildly before my daddy got home. And when Daddy came home, she would say, Earl, Jimmy did so-and-so, but I've already punished him for it, so you need not
already taken care of it.
Already taken care of it.
And she would lightly.
Lightly. But my father didn't punish us lightly. he used a switch from a peach tree, which is a very formidable weapon, I'll say. And he whipped me 5 times in my life, and I still remember every one of them. The first time was when I was a very small child, and then the last time was when I was a junior in high school.
Do you remember what brought on that punishment?
Yes, I remember each one. The youngest one, I'm kind of in a confessional mood now. Daddy would give us, my sister and me, a penny to put in the collection plate at church. He was the Sunday school teacher. And one Sunday, instead of putting a penny in the collection plate, I took a penny out. And when I got home, I had 2 pennies. So that was my first really memorable, unforgettable whipping.
How did he find out?
I guess I didn't have sense enough
not
to
show him. Yeah. And do you remember the last time?
Well, the last time was on April Fool's Day. I and all of my male classmates, we had a very small school, decided that we would leave school and go to the county seat in America's to a movie on April Fool's Day. And the principal of our school told us not to go. We went anyhow. And when we came back, the principal said we had to take a zero for that week in all of our classes and take a whipping with a paddle before we could be readmitted to the school. And my daddy added on one of his whipping. So I remember those days.
Unforgettable.
And that was the only time I skipped school.
Our 39th president, he is talking about his remarkable mother and other aspects of his life. Stay with us. Welcome back. President Jimmy Carter is with me. He's written a very loving memoir about his mother, and the book is titled simply, A Remarkable Mother. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You mentioned earlier, Mr. President, that you have visited at least 130 countries since you left office. Recently, you visited with the leader of Hamas. You made headlines the world over. Tell us why you went.
Well, there's no way to have peace in the Middle East between Israel and the neighbors without involving Hamas, who represent at least half the total Palestinian population. And I have met with Hamas leaders three times at least during the last 10 years. The first time was when Yasser Arafat was elected president of Palestinians, and they chose 88 members of the parliament at the same time in January of 1996. And when Arafat had become president, he asked me if I would meet with Hamas and urge them to accept him as their leader and to join in the cabinet with him, which I did. I tried and was unsuccessful. Later, in January of 2006, there was another election for the parliament, 10 years later, and The United States strongly supported the election, as did Israel and Fatah, which was a party of Arafat. Hamas was a major opponent. They mounted candidates for the parliament, and the Carter Center, once again, was in charge of the election in Palestine. And it was a fair, open, free election, and Hamas won, fair and square, completely safe election. And the head of the Palestinians, the president, whose name is Mahmoud Abbas, announced publicly that since Hamas had won, he was going to step down as president. So I decided to stay in the Holy Land 2 or 3 days extra to urge him to stay on as president and also to see if I could help form a unity government. So I did. I stayed there. I talked to him. He decided to stay on. And I met with the Hamas leaders, and they were willing to give the losing party, Fatah, some top portfolios, including foreign affairs, finance, and so forth, the best ones. But the United States and Israel decided at that time to declare that Hamas was a terrorist organization and was not worthy to serve in the Palestinian government, which they did. And so now, to make a long story short, Hamas is in charge of the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, and Mahmoud Abbas is, in effect, supposedly in charge of the West Bank, which is still controlled by Israel, really. So I thought it was necessary for someone to meet with Hamas, because they were eager to be included in a peace process, and they were eager to have their role in the government. So I decided to go. And, of course, the United States government, I knew the policy was not to meet with Hamas. But no one ever asked me not to go or suggested that I change my plans.
So there was a statement, no statement from the State Department as to whether you should go or not?
No, not at all.
None?
None at all. About 2 weeks before I left, as is always my custom, I put in a personal telephone call to the State Department to talk to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She was in Europe and couldn't return my call, so she had her deputy returned my call. I talked to him about 20 minutes. He never mentioned anything about my not going or not to meet with anybody. I described the whole itinerary, whom I was going to meet and that sort of thing. The only comment he made was that when I meet with the president of Syria, whose name is Assad, that I should urge him to help elect a president in Lebanon, because I knew this young president, Bashar al-Assad, when he was a college student, and which I did. And that was the only cautionary remark.
President Carter, there seems to be some real confusion here, because Secretary of State Rice said, first of all, that your talks with Hamas had not been helpful. She disputed your claim that no one in the government had tried to dissuade you from your mission. And now I'm quoting, she says, "We counseled President Carter against going to the region and particularly having contacts with Hamas. A top aide to Mr. Carter, who organized the trip, Robert Pastor, said Tuesday, the only concern the administration expressed to Mr. Carter was about his security, and so we are left with confusion." Is, you know, I mean, I, as a person who does this talk program every day, try to sort out where facts are and where lines are fuzzied.
Sure, I think that's and a worthy pursuit.
And I have appreciated your straightforwardness so much for all these years. And now the Secretary of State is contradicting you directly.
Well, she's mistaken. I issued a statement after she persisted in her erroneous comment, and pointed out that I had the greatest respect for Condoleezza Rice. I knew her to be a truthful person, and that I was certain that she had just been misinformed by her subordinates, because I know for a fact every word that was said between me and her subordinates, and I'm telling the truth, of course. And the only cautionary remark that was given to Robert Pastor, not to me, was that Gaza might be a difficult place for us to visit because it might be dangerous. So we did not even ask to go to Gaza. We missed Gaza. But I did meet with the Hamas leadership, both out of Gaza, who came to Cairo to meet with me in a hotel, the top leaders. And then I went to Damascus, Syria, where the top leaders of Hamas are, the leaders of the entire Politburo, so-called, and I met with them. And then I also met with the president of Syria, who is also being boycotted by the United States government, a very erroneous decision made in Washington.
And what do you believe you accomplished during those visits?
Well, I had an op-ed piece in the editorial in the New York Times yesterday morning that outlined it. I asked Hamas for six things, as a matter of fact. I was very carefully prepared. I keep up with the Middle East situation. First of all, I asked them to accept a decision that would be made between the Palestinians and Israel if they negotiated a peace agreement, and then it was submitted to the Palestinian people in a referendum, or if a newly elected government approved it, if they would accept it, even if it included the recognition of Israel's right to exist, to live in peace. And the Hamas leaders considered that request and others all day Saturday night, all day Sunday, and then late Sunday night they called and gave me their response. Yes, they accepted my proposal, and I could make it public. I also asked them if they would release Corporal Shalit, a young Israeli soldier, and they said they would swap Shalit for some of the 11,600 prisoners being held by Israel, about 500 of whom are women and little children, and that if Israel agreed to that proposal and the first group of prisoners was released, then they would send Shalit to Egypt, where he would be held and his parents could visit him, and then he would be released to his parents when the final prisoner exchange took place. They agreed with that, and I've announced that, and I told Shalit's parents that. Another thing that was in dispute was whether they would have a ceasefire in Gaza, because in 2007 there were 322 Palestinians killed, many of them women and children, and 8 Israelis were killed, a ratio of 40-1. And I asked them if they would accept a ceasefire, and they said they would do so if Israel would reciprocate. I tried to get them to declare a unilateral ceasefire. They said no, they had tried it. It didn't work. So after I came back to Israel, they sent me word on by telephone to Dr. Robert Pastor that they would accept that proposal, and they made it public 2 days after I left Israel that they would declare a ceasefire just in Gaza alone if Israel would reciprocate. Israel rejected that proposal. So the war and desolation continues. Earlier, that was a very important issue, because before I met with them, Hamas would only accept a ceasefire if it included Gaza and the West Bank.
I see.
And Israel rejected that. So they finally said, we'll accept Gaza alone and hope that in the future we can have the West Bank. So those are the kind of things that they agreed to do.
Do you honestly believe that in your and my lifetime we are going to see peace in the Middle East?
Yes, with one proviso. If the leaders of Israel are ever willing to swap Palestinian land for peace, at this point, the answer to that is no. Although a substantial majority of Israelis always, for the last 30 or 35 years, have said we are willing to give up Palestinian land that we have confiscated and colonized in exchange for peace. And lately, in the last 2 or 3 years, every Arab country, all 22 of them, have agreed under the leadership of King Abdullah from Saudi Arabia that they would recognize Israel's right to exist, to live in peace, and have diplomatic relations with Israel and normal trade relations with Israel if Israel would just do that, withdraw from Palestinian land to this pre-67 borders. And so that is the answer to your question. So far, since the big, highly publicized and non-substantive meeting in Annapolis in November, the number of new settlements announced by Israel has been almost 9,000, I understand. And instead of removing the roadblocks so the Palestinians can move from one place to another in their own territory, the number of roadblocks has been increased. And the imprisonment of the 1.5 million Palestinians who live in Gaza has been tightened. So there's no evidence at all at this point that the so-called roadmap of President Bush is being accepted by Israel or that there's any move toward peace.
President Jimmy Carter, his new book about the adored woman in his life is titled A Remarkable Mother. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The current president, George W. Bush, has made a speech this morning on the economy. The Fed is meeting today and tomorrow. One of the decisions expected is perhaps a cutting of the prime rate by 0.25%. What is your view of the U.S. economy and the situation in which we currently find ourselves, including this terrible mortgage crisis?
Well, of course, the whole world knows that we're in a desperate condition as far as the mortgage rates have brought our economy. I believe that this would bring the prime rate down to 2%, which is a very low level in an attempt to stimulate the economy. The basic cause of it is that in the last 7.5 years, there's been an abominable decrease in the tax rates for the extremely rich people in our country. And this has brought us unprecedented deficits in our overall economy. And I think it's weakened the dollar. The dollar is now at its lowest level almost in my lifetime. And I'm quite old. And it continues to go down. And so I think the sum total of that is a disastrous economic policy that this administration has perpetrated against the American people at the cost of the well-being of the working families of America.
And you believe it began with the cutting of the tax rates?
Well, there's no doubt about that. When President Clinton left office, as you know, we had a healthy surplus. And now we have the highest deficit by far that our country has ever seen. We've just been spending more money each year. And the income that would ordinarily be derived from the richest people paying taxes has been pretty well abolished by this administration.
And we are, of course, in a time of war in Iraq.
Absolutely, an unnecessary war.
An unnecessary war, as you have said before on this program and elsewhere. And yet, the American people have not seen an increase of taxes to pay for it. However, they are seeing inflation in food, a shortage of food going on. Do you see a connection between all of these things?
Yes, I do. I said early on in the program, we've been in a lot of countries, and most of the countries in which the Carter Center does its work are very poor. 35 of them are in Africa. And food prices have skyrocketed. In the last 6 or 8 months, the price of rice has more than doubled. And now we see major firms in the United States that sell groceries limiting the sale of rice, for instance, Sam's and others, Costco. And this is uncomfortable for rich Americans, but it's devastating for a family that lives on less than a dollar a day for housing, clothing, food, medical care, and everything else, when they have their price of grain which is their main source of nutrients, double within a year's time. So this is caused by the economic policies of our country to some degree, but it's also caused by an unnecessary emphasis on taking food grains and making ethanol out of it. Last year, for instance, I noticed the statistics, 18% of our corn produced in this country was exported, and another 18% was used for ethanol. Well, this is not going to work in the long term, and the people have been misled about it. The proper source for ethanol is cellulose, fibers from trees and switchgrass and things like that, not food that comes out of people's stomachs.
Former President Jimmy Carter, his newest book is titled A Remarkable Mother. We'll take a short break and then your calls. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate, Is Healthcare a Right? Video, transcript, and broadcast details are at millercenter.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about editing a new collection of poems by Elizabeth Bishop. And psychologist Dr. Dan Gottlieb describes making peace with his damaged body, a body which he believes is now wearing out. A 1979 car accident left him paralyzed from the waist down. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we have comments from President Bush's news conference that took place this morning. The president declined to openly criticize former President Carter for his meetings last week with representatives of Hamas, the Palestinian group the State Department considers a terrorist organization. Quote, anybody can talk to whomever they want, but I want people to understand the problem is Hamas, said President Bush. Foreign policy and peace is undermined by Hamas. That's the reason I'm not talking with them. President Carter, how do you feel about that?
Well, the problem is the United States and Israel not talking to half the people in Palestine. And the representatives that won a fair election just 2 years ago. And I think the problem is exacerbated by the fact that the United States also won't talk to Syria. And everybody knows that there can't be peace between Israel and its neighbors until Israel withdraws from the Golan Heights. Israel has agreed to this, by the way. They don't claim that they own it. They claim it's Israel. It's Syria's. And when we met with President Assad, Bashar al-Assad, he made it plain that he was very eager to talk to Israel, but the United States was forbidding such talks. So I think the foolishness of this administration in not talking to people who disagree with Washington really sometimes exacerbates or exaggerates a problem that already exists.
What about this new evidence that Syria was working on developing a nuclear weapon?
Well, they laugh about that when it was brought up. They said, we can't afford to even have a reactor that makes electricity, much less afford a reactor that would be extremely costly that would make weapons. I don't know the answer, though, to your question. I'm just telling you what the leaders of Syria say.
So
I don't know.
You don't know
No. Whether
they were, in fact, and whether the evidence presented to us in the newspaper and on television.
I really haven't seen that evidence because I just returned recently from a long trip and I haven't seen the news lately.
All right.
I do know that the people in both Israel and the United States strongly approve of my meeting with Hamas. There was a poll done a public opinion poll done in Israel about a week before I left home. It was published in the Washington Post and on CNN. 64% of the Jewish people who live in Israel, not counting the Arabs, said they strongly approve of Israel itself negotiating directly with Hamas because the people of Israel know what's happening. So that's two-thirds of the Israeli people. And I was on Larry King last night, and they had a CNN poll that was maybe superficial and quick, but 70% of the people that called in said they approved of my meeting with Hamas. The informed people know that Hamas must be included if we're ever going to have peace in the Middle East.
All right, and let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. President Carter, I wanted to, first of all, let you know that indeed it's a pleasure and honor to speak with you, and we appreciate your service, particularly in the Middle East. You've always shown quiet courage. And I have a question. There seems to be a big push, personally I think it's being led by Israel, for us to attack Iran. We've had the Admiral Fallon has resigned, and that apparently the dominoes are falling in place for this administration to either support the Israeli attack on Iran or to join in on it. And particularly with the, like Diane was saying, with the advent of these photographs of a so-called nuclear reactor that was being built by the allegedly by the Koreans for the Syrians. And in the past, as you know, the Israelis have attacked Iraq when they blew up the reactor, many years ago.
So your question, John.
My question is, what can we do to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think the last thing we ought to do is to bomb or send missiles against Iran, which would precipitate a war that would be much worse than what we faced when we entered Iraq under false pretenses. The most logical thing we could do is for this administration to talk to Iran. We refuse to talk to Hamas. We refuse to talk to Syria. We refuse to talk to Iran. Anybody who disagrees with us, we won't even have diplomatic relations or talk to them. So I think that if the United States would join in with the European nations and discuss directly with Iran, then we could work out the problem peacefully.
Thanks for calling, John. Now to Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, Hal.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. President. I'm honored to speak with you. I'm the only Democrat presidential candidate that I ever voted for was JFK. And I'm totally confused with our three top running candidates. And I would love to have your perspective, critique of the three candidates, and if you could voice your opinion as to who might be the best candidate.
Well, I agree with you on one thing. I voted for JFK also. But that's the only election for president you and I have ever voted the same way, because I voted for Democrats the rest of the time. Well, I will support the Democratic nominee. I think it's time for a change in Washington. After this 7.5 years of completely erroneous decisions on international and domestic affairs, including the unwarranted war in Iraq, threats to bomb or attack Iran, refusal to meet with people who disagree with us, and so forth, just in foreign affairs, and an economy that's been savaged because of the extraordinary tax giveaways to the richest people in America to the expense of working families. So I'm going to vote for one of the Democrats. A lot of people deplore the intensity of the Democratic campaign fight. I don't have any concern about that. My mother, if she was still here, would have said, let them fight. And if she had been one of the candidates, she would never have given up until the last vote was counted. In the Democratic Party, the last vote would be counted on the 3rd of June. And my opinion is that after that, the Democrats are going to come back together and support the victorious candidate. I'm a superdelegate, having been a president. And so I will refrain from making any endorsement or expressing my preference until after the primary season is
Tell me what you make of the Reverend Wright and the impact that you believe his statements both yesterday and earlier could have on the candidacy of Barack Obama.
I think the comments that have been repetitively emphasized have hurt Obama. But I believe that the damage is transient. I grew up in a community, as I said earlier, that I didn't have any white neighbors. All of my neighbors were black. The biggest and most dominant person was an African Methodist Episcopal bishop, William Dexter Johnson, who spoke in the local church. And I would guess that his sermons would be almost identical to what Reverend Wright has been preaching lately. Plains, Georgia, now has about 635 people. We have 8 churches in town and 3 more churches right around the outside of town, 11 churches for 635 people. The biggest church by far is the African American Baptist Church, Lebanon Baptist Church. And I've been to services there many times. And that's the kind of sermon you hear in a black church, because many of the older pastors still remember the segregation years when the United States government, the Supreme Court, the Congress, and everybody else said separate but equal. And everybody knows, particularly the black people know, it wasn't equal. It was separate, but they were severely deprived. So I think that a modern-day younger pastor like Otis Moss III, who now is taking over that church, will probably be much more moderate in his comments. But that kind of sermon is well known to people like me who've lived around and been to many Baptist churches.
Were you ever moved to get up and leave because of what someone said?
No, not out of church service. I've disagreed with some of the fiery statements that were made in the emotion of the moment. And you have to remember that in some churches that are somewhat charismatic and so forth, the speakers get completely carried away with what they're saying. And sometimes they make remarks that after 20 years of cold analysis might seem to be quite irrational.
How well do you think Barack Obama has handled this issue?
I watched his speech on that subject that he made. In fact, I called up the New York Times on the website, and they had an audio version of it. I watched it all. I was moved to tears because I've lived, and my life has been blighted at my early years because I live within a totally segregated and discriminatory society. And that's one of the reasons that when I was elected president, governor first, in my very brief inaugural speech, I said, I tell you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over. And when I became president, I announced that the human rights would be a basic foundation of our foreign policy. And I think I derived these commitments to human rights or civil rights from knowing how horribly we had treated our African-American neighbors.
But is there still sufficient racial animosity in this country that you believe could prevent Barack Obama from becoming president?
No, I don't. I think it has dissipated dramatically in the last few years. And the fact that Obama has done as well as he could has been proof that what I just said is accurate. As a matter of fact, Georgia, which is an extremely conservative state, voted overwhelmingly for Obama. And I don't know what's going to happen in the general election. My little town of Plains, it has about 180 people who vote each time, voted overwhelmingly for Obama. And it's very conservative on the race issue. So I think there's a changing time.
Interesting. Now to Jacksonville, Florida. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, President Carter. How are you?
Fine.
I graduated from Auburn University, and you were writing about your mother, and she had a stint at Auburn where she was a house mother at a fraternity.
At a KA fraternity.
And I wanted you to comment about what it was like for a Southern lady to work around these wild 19 to 20, 21-year-old fraternity boys as a house mother. I thought that was an interesting career move for her relatively later in life.
Well, I hope you'll read my book about it. As a matter of fact, mother adopted, not by mistake, the wildest and most rambunctious fraternity on the campus, and that was a Kappa Alphas, the KAs. They had that reputation, and Mama relished being the house mother of those boys. And now whenever I meet one, like if I'm on an airplane and somebody comes up and said, I was one of the KAs, and your mother was a house mother, I said, have you stayed out of prison? And they always laugh. But those boys were, obviously, they went on to become very successful in life, as most of the Auburn graduates do. But I think mother really enjoyed that experience.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hi, Don.
Yes, ma'am. Nice to be speaking with you, Mr. Carter.
It's good.
I was calling to comment on your economic values about the price of, grain. And I haul, freight in a tractor trailer. And people are complaining about, the price going up now. But can you imagine next year it's going to be more than double than what it is now, because the price of hauling freight has more than tripled in the past year. And, I mean, it's going to have to go up. And, is there anything that the government can do to, reduce the price of fuel? Because it's killing everyone.
Well, there's some things that the government could do in the long term. And, that is to make sure that we have more efficient automobiles, that we use fuel that's not derived from foreign sources and that sort of thing. I'm a farmer. I grow corn, cotton, peanuts, soybeans, wheat, and so forth. And let me just give you one statistic. In addition to the freight hauling, what has caused the price of grain to go up? In January of last year, 2007, diammonium phosphate, which is one of our standard fertilizers, was $260 a ton. Last Saturday, that had gone from $260 to $1,003 in not much more than 1 year. So fertilizer and fuel and the price of hauling has skyrocketed, and I don't think that there's a short-term solution to it. But obviously, when the government doesn't conserve fuel and let the oil companies and the automobile manufacturers continue their powerful lobbies so that we use gas-guzzling SVUs instead of efficient automobiles like every other country in the world is now doing, that's one of the causes of the price of fuel going up.
Thanks for calling, Don. Mr. President, I have one last question for you. I have interviewed your lovely wife as well as you, reading this book about your remarkable mother. I found myself wondering, because of my own experience with my own mother-in-law, what your wife's experience was with your mother.
That's an interesting question. Rosa and I were in the Navy for a long time, and I never intended to get out of the Navy. I came home in 1953 to be at my father's bedside when he was dying with pancreatic cancer, and I had an epiphany. I decided on the spur of the moment to resign from the Navy. I went back to Schenectady, New York, where we were stationed. I was in charge of the 2nd Atomic Submarine, and told Rosa I was getting out of the Navy. She was absolutely furious because she feared that she would go back to Plains and be dominated by my very dominant mother. So all the way from Schenectady to Plains, when we drove home finally, she never spoke a word to me. she would say if she had to stop at a restroom, she'd say, Jack, tell your father I need to stop at a restroom. So she was furious with me, but she and my mother got along quite well. They're both powerful women, and they learned to protect their own territory and not encroach too much on each other.
Former President Jimmy Carter, his new book with a beautiful photograph on the cover is titled A Remarkable Mother. Thank you so much, Mr. President.
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.